Robots Radio. Games, lore, stories, community. Just press play.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, weary traveler. Need a short rest? Oh, I see. They said you'd be showing up about now. Come on, through the portal. Best not keep the Lore Mistress and Lore Master waiting. You know how they get.
Robots Radio presents the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. The best way for everyone from experienced dungeon masters to those curious about D&D to learn more about the worlds, creatures, and lore of Dungeons & Dragons.
Hello and welcome to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. My name is Sergio.
And I'm Mary.
And we are continuing our Planescape coverage this week. We're just jumping right into it. There's Planescape for obvious reasons. You know, you might guess that it has a lot to do with the planes of Dungeons & Dragons and D&D lore. And that's exactly what we're going to cover. Yeah, we're going to cover that over a period.
Like the entirety of the scape of them? Like they're
the whole landscape.
The whole scape of the planes.
The whole scape of the planes. We're going to spend 3 weeks covering all of these. And so the original Planescape campaign setting released in, 1995, 1994.
I thought it was 96 for some reason.
That might have been Torment is when Torment came
out. That might be Torment,
which we will also be talking about. So the original Planescape campaign setting came out in 94, and they put out three different box sets, one for the chaos or the Planes of Law, which covers the more lawful aligned planes, the Planes of Chaos, which kind of tended toward more evil type planes, and then the Planes of Conflict, which despite the name is actually the planes that kind of tend toward neutrality, but not
that's
just
where
like
the conflict comes from,
right? And so like not to where not just like the more the most basic idea of neutrality when you think of it, but more so the idea of neutrality, like based on the plane itself.
Right.
So, it's own form of neutrality. It's what, how it kind of tweaks in. Sometimes it tends toward a little, chaotic. Sometimes it tends toward a little good, but right. And so that's what we're going to talk about this week. We're going to cover four of the six planes within the original Planes of Conflict box set. And then two of them we're going to keep for our Patreon Plus installment. So if you're interested in hearing about all six of them, definitely check out D&D Lorecast over on patreon.com.
Oh, it's true. Get that and a bunch of other really great stuff with it.
Oh yeah, in addition to the
early access and
bonus content you get, early access, you get merchandise, stickers, shirts, and all sorts of cool stuff.
All sorts
tote
of
bags for crying out loud. But yeah, so yeah, in the Patreon Plus installment, we'll be covering the Beastlands and also Carcery.
Okay.
So let's go ahead and get started with Elysium.
Ooh, okay.
The most relaxed, restful place in all the multiverse. Here, sods don't care about a cutter's race, faction, hair color, or choice of accessories. That is, as long as she ain't evil or looking for trouble. Because you see, Elysium is only concerned with the good. Neither law nor anarchy matters. Just good. And that comes from a barrier, which is a centaur-like creature named, and I love the name, like the name and the species combined is just fantastic. Stone Kick Swift Hoof.
Yep. That's a centaur, all right. That's centaur-ish. A centaur.
Yeah, he's a retired adventurer who I guess, you know, makes his home in Elysium, which is the plane embodying the concept of pure good without being overly restricted by law or dissipated by the randomness of chaos. Some characteristics of this plane were ascribed to Heliopolis and the House of Nature in the old World Tree cosmology model. And there are also four layers to Elysium. Most of their features are found near the banks of the river Oceanus, which links the plane with the two upper planes, which is Beastlands and Arborea. So Oceanus, that's like the counterpart to the River Styx,
okay,
which flows through the lower planes as we went through our Nine Hells tour.
As we went familiar, through hell.
Yeah, duly familiar with the River Styx.
Yep.
Except that Oceanus only has natural hazards, nothing man-made or creature-made, and actually contains potable water. Like, you can actually just go up there and drink it. I wouldn't recommend drinking.
So it's not like magically cursed?
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend drinking from the River Styx.
No, I mean, unless you intend on forgetting and losing yourself completely.
I mean, if that's
unless
the
that's
case,
what you're after.
Yeah, if that's the case, go nuts.
Right, I'm not going to yuck your yum, but if you want to keep yourself, don't do it. Not even a sip. Don't let it get on you. Mm-mm.
So lands near Oceanus, near the riverbanks, they're lush with trees like pines, you know, flowers that fill the air with a natural sort of perfume. And then further from the river, the trees get a little bit smaller, still around though. And then, you know, they kind of start to, that whole thing starts to, like the vegetation starts to thin out the further away you get from the river, until finally, after, you know, hundreds of miles or kilometers, the forest gives way to vast greenlands, you know, more other fertile regions like, you know, farmlands, until eventually becomes sort of like desert badlands. And I thought this was a pretty interesting note that Elysian pears are considered some of the best tasting fruit and are sold as far as Sigil. You know, so Sigil is one of those places, you know, one of those, you know, we talked about Sigil a little bit a couple weeks ago, and, you know, that's one of those places where you can kind of find everything.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want just that that great tasting Elysian pear, that's the place to get it.
I'll keep that in mind if I'm ever brave enough to venture out that way.
I just keep imagining making the band with P. Diddy that mm-hmm. was lampooned by on Chappelle's Show.
Mm-hmm.
And like, just like your mission is to go out and get an Elysian pear for like a rap mogul or like a bard, like a famous bard, and you're trying and you're like interning under him, and he's like, I want you to go to Sigil and find me an Elysian pear. That's just where my mind goes. I don't know where anyone else's mind goes. Anyways, in Elysium there are no sun, there are no moons, no stars.
Oh.
Except those that the inhabiting powers manifest. You know, they're created by moving about in different kinds of vessels, or actually moving their entire realms across the skies. All right, so these three layers that, or four layers, I'm sorry, that Elysium is broken up into.
Mm-hmm.
The first layer, Amoria, it's also referred to as the quote innermost layer. is connected to the astral plane by these color pools and to Twin Paradises, Happy Hunting Grounds, other planes, you know, within the cosmology, and also the concordant opposition by unmarked portals that are located in dark caverns. So as we go through all these planes, there are going to be many that are connected in one way or another, you know, some in more traditional ways, some in very not traditional ways, like perhaps an unmarked portal located in a dark cavern.
Wow, that's oddly specific.
Yeah, now that I say that, in terms of D&D, that's actually pretty standard.
Like, pretty standard fare.
Right, yeah. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, IRL, like you gotta, it's unmarked. You won't be able to tell it. It's also in a dark cavern. I'm like, that's a weird place to put something. But in terms of D&D, like, actually, that makes sense. Par for the course.
It's exactly where I would put a portal somewhere I didn't want other people to go.
Right, right. But you can determine where these portals are and where they go by using divination spells. So you're able to do that.
Ooh, okay.
Navigating the river Oceanus downstream will also lead you to the Happy Hunting Grounds. But any other, any underground passages, probably not the safest to take by boat. Amoria best fits the description given above, and the river Oceanus as many side channels that split and merge back again, creating these kind of like banks for the establishment of realms.
Mm-hmm.
The second layer of Elysium, very mountainous, many branches of the Oceanus River that become spectacular waterfalls, tumbling cascades before forming channels that are bordered by these really like steep cliffs of gray rock. And like Amoria, Aronia supports abundant wildlife along those banks. So Aronia, the second layer, is marked by a rising landscape, those aforementioned kind of like steep hills, steep cliffs, and mountains that rise beyond brightly lit clouds from deep valleys of white granite. And at the bottom of these valleys, the river Oceanus flows in a winding pattern, cutting canyons and gorges and flowing in rapids and extremely tall cascades. I mean, like, sort of like, seems like if you're an outdoorsman, kind of like a wet dream.
It sounds lovely.
I mean, it sounds pretty great.
It does, yeah.
This is the most dangerous section of the river's course, though.
Of course.
And I mean, it's, you got to respect nature. And there's a great bit later on in the episode, one of the quotes that start off each plane that I discuss about respecting nature. And it's just, again, like, the writing in Planescape is just fantastic.
It is absolutely phenomenal, and praises cannot be sung enough.
So this is the most dangerous section of the river and can only be successfully navigated with these experienced, you know, folks who call themselves river rats. So
of course they do.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I like, you know,
that's,
I was
going to yeah, say, like,
if
of
other
course
people
that's what they're
call
called.
Them that, that seems a little derogative, but if they call themselves that, then by all means, go nuts.
Oh, yeah.
Unlike Amoria, Aronia has a larger variability in the seasons. You know, more typical, traditional, like harsher winters, hotter summers than the typically temperate regions of even like the prime material world plane. You know, windy snow, lightning storms are common. In fact, the wind can be so strong that throughout the layer that flying creatures have their maneuverability while they're flying considerably compromised.
Okay, so that, again, that's a reflection of some of the lower planes as well.
Right, right. And then the third layer, Beleriand, contrary to Aronia, this layer, which is often known as the Forgotten Layer, is mostly flat with marshes and wetlands, stretching inland for, you know, miles or kilometers before larger plants and trees are to be found. This gives me like swampy Florida, Louisiana vibes for sure.
Yep.
Oceanus splits and forms many little island nations inhabited by extraplanar beings in this layer. And the river also flows slowly through the layer into a tangle of channels that sort of like weave around sandbars and mangrove forests. And in some places, rocky ridges rise above the bog, making for stable terrain.
So the south.
Kinda, yeah. I mean, exactly. Yes. Like,
it's the whole river rats aspect. Yeah. Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and so this is where communities and towns are found. So
okay.
Yeah. So essentially, like this terrain, this land is decent enough to like live permanently, or at least you know, somewhat permanently in. Mm-hmm. This is where we're going to build.
Oh, okay. Okay. So that's where the cabins are to go visit. And,
right.
You know,
right.
Go and camping and hang out.
And they're usually built around lighthouses that serve as, you know, just like in the real world, navigation beacons to aid travelers.
Lighthouses.
The lighthouses in D&D also serve as lighthouses.
Oh, okay. Well, to be fair, it's D&D. You really never know.
They'll be like
a lighthouse. I'm sure there's a DM that's done a lighthouse and it's just an actual house that doesn't weigh very much.
It just floats away.
Yeah, it just floats away if you don't tie it down.
Right. So despite the generally desolate nature of the lair, the good influence of Elysium could still be felt in Beleriand in the form of the shiny nature of the fog itself and this sort of luminous vapor that surrounds every light source. And I love some of the lore surrounding the lair. It says that in ancient times, the Gardenelles, which is this type of like animalistic celestial, think like a lion man, but also kind of an angel.
Okay.
So they encountered a legendary Hydra in one of their quests. Mm-hmm. You know, thought to be the mythical, unique Hydra that spawned all other Hydras.
Mm-hmm.
So unable to defeat it, the Gardenelles use a teleport spell and they move the Hydra to Beleriand, after which they closed all portals that led, you know, out of the lair and sealed it off from divination magic.
And as so,
kind of as a prison. Okay. Yeah, this effectively turned the lair into this sort of like infinite cage.
Yeah.
And the only exit was the river Oceanus itself. Whose blessed waters the Hydra could not touch.
So that's a whole other layer of cruelty.
I mean, it is Hydra. A Hydra after
it's
all.
Got Hydra in its name. You can't keep it away from the water. That's messed up. Poor little thing. Poor little babies.
You're going to die booping something. I swear.
It's going to happen. I'm sure. But at least I'll have fun and I'll go happy.
Not just the Hydra, but other powerful entities are rumored to like share this prison, more or less. The number and nature of the other prisoners is not known, but mm-hmm. rumors exist of a creature similar to the Tarrasque, mm-hmm. A legendary black dragon, a captured archdevil, a demon lord, and even a wounded deity. So this lair is chock full of possibility.
It is. That's an adventure. You just like dropped so many adventure hooks. Did you get a sale? Did you get them on sale?
Dude, for
bulk
real.
Buy this time? Like,
absolutely. And finally, the fourth and quote outermost layer of Elysium was a great ocean, sometimes called the Thalassian Sea. And this is both the source and the final destination of the river Oceanus. No like large land masses exist, mm-hmm. but instead we get smaller green islands that are collectively known as Avalon, and they're kind of scattered around. Some of these islands are rumored to be inhabited by great heroes from the primaterial plane. So mm-hmm. I love that. That's kind of like how billionaires in real life have like their own islands. I like the fact, you know, thinking like maybe like Elminster or Dritz like have an island on the fourth layer of Elysium. They could only be reached by travelers who sought the aid of those heroes, and only even after certain conditions are met, you know, determined by the hero's individual legends.
Again,
just
more
story hook after story hook after story hook.
And like, so, you find one more? It's like the scene in every movie where they tell somebody to leave your weapons here, and they've always got like one or two more in their boot, and an obscene number of weapons. That's what you're doing here with plot hooks, and it's beautiful. It's beautiful.
And more recently, in terms of the timeline, Heliopolis is eventually destroyed, essentially destroyed in the spell plague. And the House of Nature is then split into two parts, one of which becomes the Deep Wilds, and the others merge with the Green Field. So that's kind of where we stand with Elysium today.
Right.
Now, that was one of the, you know, neutral layers that kind of like lean toward good. I'm going to jump on over to the evil just because I like talking about that more.
I've noticed that.
I mean, Elysium's dope. I mean, like I said,
it's
very cool, but just something that scratches that itch when it comes to the naughty parts.
I don't think that you should say scratching that itch and the naughty parts in the same sentence.
Everyone knows you're definitely
not talking about.
I'm talking about D&D. Talking about Dungeons and Dragons.
Right.
Gehenna, the furnace of perdition. comprises episode start at the beginning. Gehenna, the furnace of perdition, comprises exactly four steep volcanoes with peaks at the top and bottom and nary a flat stretch in between. These volcanoes are huge, literally hundreds of thousands of miles across, up and down. Still, it doesn't hide the fact that Gehenna is, overall, one of the smallest planes in physical area. But what Gehenna lacks in size, it makes up for in sheer mean-spiritedness.
This is true.
So, a plane totally and completely without charity, without any concept of pity, of mercy, or really any other redeeming quality. So essentially, Gehenna is completely irredeemable. I love that.
Well, at least it's honest about it.
Yeah, at least they own it, you know?
Beyond redemption.
Again, four layers within Gehenna. Infinite planes with gravity at a 45-degree angle to the ground. That makes travelers feel like as if they're always climbing like up the side of a mountain that has no base or peak. Like you're just always in the middle of the climb.
That's worse than most of the stuff in the Nine Hells. I'm just going to throw this out there as somebody who has vertigo frequently. That's terrible.
Oh yeah, you wouldn't.
That's the worst.
I
would
day.
Hate it. Or I would actually feel like I was normal for once.
Maybe. Like that episode of The Simpsons, the Halloween episode where Homer sells his soul for a donut and so goes to hell. And he's like, you eat all the donuts in the world and just keeps eating. And the devil's like, I doesn't make any sense. That would be you.
Yes.
Everyone's like, I can't do this. And you're like, I've never felt more normal in my life.
This is so strange to feel normal.
Anyone that loses their footing, so anyone besides you, could tumble for dozens, if not hundreds of miles or kilometers before finding enough purchase on the slope to stop their fall. Nearly all the terrain that was not, a river of either water or a river of lava was slippery enough to, it was either like slightly slippery or pretty like really slick, almost, untraversable. And so all structures are either built onto the slopes or carved into the slopes. Heat and light come from the ground, much like Tartarus, which we will discuss in the Patreon Plus.
Ooh.
But the source was volcanic. Lava flows, fumaroles, mud pots are very common, as well as earthquakes and obviously volcanic eruptions occurring very often, tearing the land apart. On the hotter of the layers, unprotected flammable items and creatures, so like your things and your friends and you, would catch fire.
Flammable creatures. I'm one of those.
Like, yeah,
I'm a flammable creature.
Yeah, any flammable items and or flammable creatures would catch fire from the glowing ground or even from the superheated gases being ejected.
Like, oh,
that's how hot the gases are, like the vapors that you could catch fire.
Yeah.
The barriers between the layers are always underground, usually in dead-end corridors. And the uppermost layer, Colossus, is the most livable of the four, you know, with waterfalls cascading down the slopes, the largest, coming from the river Styx. The Styx flows through a rough path, down the slope, falls for thousands of feet or meters, and runs through twisty rapids before finally disappearing again into underground passages.
So the safest place is the one with the river Styx?
Yeah, exactly.
Huh. That sounds terrible. I love it.
So this combination of heat and the river Styx causes steam to rise into an infinite and empty black sky that makes the horizon glow this sort of dull red. And it might not surprise you, but Kallus touches the astral plane and has connections to Hades and the nine hells.
What?
Imagine that. Shock of shocks.
What? The river Styx connects things to the nine hells. This, in other news,
hell is hot. And
hell is hot.
Texas is hot.
So is Texas. It's worse.
And these portals usually appear as black chasms in the floor of deep underground caverns. And, while there's no way of telling where they might lead, intelligent travelers, which is to say probably not your average D&D PC, they have made markings on the wall by many of them to indicate the portal's destination if one could read them.
Oh, gosh.
So I see at least some of the players I've played with. Like, you come across this portal, you don't know where it leads to. You see markings on the wall, this, that, and the other. It's like, I'm just going to jump into the portal. Well, maybe you should examine the damn car. Ugh, never mind. Never mind.
Okay,
forget it.
Sure. Go for it.
This lair is also home to the Throne of Blood, which is the realm of Baal. Our old friend Baal. Have we had a ball episode?
I don't think we have, but we should because it'll be a ball.
God, I can't with you anymore. I can't. No more show.
You say
show.
That every time, and yet you keep.
You say
you can't, but you do.
I love D&D lore more than I hate your puns.
Dang.
That's a lot of
love. That's a lot of hate, too.
So the second layer of Gehenna is also known as the Molten. Goes by the name of, it's Kamada or Chamada. I'm gonna go Kamada. And it's
I don't know what Chamada with you.
Damn it!
Sorry.
And so the most, it's
I'll
the most
you.
violently active layer, with lava cascading thousands of miles or kilometers wide. City-sized volcanoes, yawning open on the slopes, air, filled with this acrid smoke that causes blindness to unprotected eyes and has the effect of a stinking cloud to the lungs. I mean, this is just...
Well, that's what's Chamada.
that's
all of that? You answered my question. Thank you.
That's what's Chamada. So a lot of, where people find their sort of refuge is in underground caves, because below ground, the air is fresher, but still, and I love this, stank of burning flesh and hair.
Ew.
Yep.
That's terrible.
This layer houses the Tower Arcane, which is the great library of the Arcanoloths, which contains all the recorded history of the Yugoloths and all their records and contracts of their participation in the Blood War.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The third layer, Mungoth, was a land of falling ash and burning snow. That's why it's known as Burning Ice.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Far, right. Yeah, far less volcanically active than, you know, than Kalas and Shamara.
Mm-hmm.
But still, like, the volcanoes aren't completely extinct. There's always that. It's always that threat of volcano. Right. The furnaces of this layer are fewer and farther apart, which allows the ice and snow to build up in, you know, the darker places between the active mm-hmm. areas. Nevertheless, temperatures across the layer are pretty low, so that it's almost always under a constant snowfall. And so travelers have to be sure to to survive and brave the never-ending avalanches of wet snow and fiery rock. It's like, as if it's not one thing, it's the other. Exactly.
I see why they're planes of conflict now.
Upon hitting the ground, the snow and ash mixture turns into this like really like thick mud that makes the slopes also very slippery. When the snow mixes with volcanic ash, it turns acidic and could rapidly damage, you know, unprotected living creatures, burning through, you know, ordinary clothing. Although, much like the layer above, you know, underground passages, you know, can make travel relatively safe. In fact, you know, because the mudslides and the lava flows are so common and frequently bury the caves that could serve as temporary shelters, that's why people have to stay on the move. Can't really huddle down for too long.
Sounds ways to torture players. It sounds amazing and awful.
As a DM, it sounds incredible. You're right. As a player, it sounds like the worst.
It's pretty off-mazing.
So the final and fourth layer is Krangath. The name literally means dead furnaces because it's completely devoid of any volcanic activity, even underground. Everything's dark. Everything's cold. Although the rock composing the slopes are volcanic in origin, the layer has been, you know, extinct in this way for at least, it says, several millennia, at least by the mid-14th century DR. And not only is it geologically dead, the layer is also devoid of any other signs of life. And this, to me, is the creepiest. There's no wind, no source of light or heat, no natural sounds. The only thing that your senses pick up is this pervasive smell of brimstone.
Don't like that.
Right? Exactly. Like, you know, it's completely still, except you smell like a hint of hell.
Ah, oh, to hell. Coming soon.
The only times that wind does blow on this layer is when the occasional portal, like, shifts the air. And then the only sounds heard are the distant footsteps of those leaving or arriving. The layer's rare petitioners kept very quiet for fear of being discovered by its residing lich lord. Now, keep in mind, I said is devoid of any other signs of life. That doesn't mean that the undead don't chill here.
There are signs of unlife?
Absolutely.
Boy.
So, there's
That's
a city
somehow
here.
Worse than it being empty. Maybe worse than it being empty, but I don't know.
So there's a city
empty's
here.
Still pretty problematic. Okay.
Hopelorn, that's inhabited by liches and other undead spellcasters,
perfectly
including
named.
Malif the Lich Lord, who is often described as the ruler of the lair. And also in researching this, I discovered Shargas, the orcish god of the cold, the dark, and the night.
Oh.
A patron of orcs that acted stealthily in the shadows.
Could support that.
Oh, yeah, he's awesome. Shargas is also known as the Stalker Below or the Night Lord. And he plots the death of the living from the lightless realms deep beneath the surface.
He sounds amazing.
He sounds like he's going to have his own dang episode. That's what he sounds like.
He does. Yeah. Yeah, he does.
But for right now, we are going to jump to the middle of the show, talk our middle of the show stuff, and then we'll be back to finish up the Planes of Conflict. Welcome to the middle of the show. Of course, the middle of the show is where we take a short break from the lore so we can do a little bit of housekeeping, like keeping you up to date on any D&D news, digging into the DM's Guild or some other type of homebrew, see what kind of fun shenanigans the homebrew community is getting into. And of course, plugging our socials and obviously thanking all of the patrons. Thank you so much to all the folks that are supporting the show over at patreon.com/dndlorecast. And a special shout out to our newest patron, Rich F. Thank you so much for signing up. You'll get bonus content. You'll get a sticker pack. I promise they will be in the mail soon, as well as early ad-free episodes each and every time. So once again, thank you so much. Your support on Patreon helps us do stuff that we normally couldn't do, like pay artists to commission artwork for merchandise or for the upcoming Magic Items book. But if you want to support the show in other ways, you absolutely can. Of course, going to Spotify, going to Apple Podcasts and leaving 5-star reviews, just talking us up to anyone, you know, following us on the socials, communicating with us in that way. We're pretty much everywhere at D&D Lorecast, whether it be X/Twitter. I'm never going to get used to calling it X. Threads, Mastodon, Blue Sky, Twitch, Instagram, TikTok, or at DND Lorecast. The branding is strong with us. I have to admit, like, that's, if we haven't done much right, we definitely got that right. So definitely check us out all over Lady Gaga's internet. And as far as D&D news, well, everything is pretty much ramping up towards the full Phandelver campaign book coming out here in a couple weeks. And we will, of course, have our first impressions right before it comes out to give you, let you know if it's worth your time. If it's anything like the original starter set adventure, you know, the mini adventure of Phandelver, I'm sure it's going to be awesome. It still stands as one of the best adventures in 5th edition. And then, of course, Baldur's Gate 3 is still, still hanging on to, has a grip on the gaming community. Will Starfield, Bethesda Starfield, help loosen it? Only time will tell. But so far, Baldur's Gate has been a huge hit. And as far as homebrew goes, usually we try to suggest something that is in keeping, that has some sort of tie to the subject that we're discussing. In this case, Planescape, the Planes of Conflict. However, this week and for the next few weeks, I want to do a little something different. I recently participated in a adventure writing workshop that was held by Jaden King and Beth the Bard. Jaden King, you may know them from all sorts of TTRPG work across all manner of companies, D&D in a Castle, and Beth the Bard, you may know from She is the Ancient, a gender-bent Curse of Strahd, who is an official platinum seller on the DM's Guild and can just released their hardcover copy of the book, or even Daughter of Frankenstein, their successful Kickstarter campaign, which we definitely backed and are, can't wait to get our hands on. But yeah, so I participated in a adventure writing workshop with them. Still have not finished my personal adventure. But for the next few weeks, I want to highlight some of the other students, some of the other participants in the workshop, some of their what they produce, what their amazing imaginative minds produced. And this week we're starting off with Nerdy Emma's Echoes of the Lost. The mining company ignored the disturbing history of Mount Kalva. 7 days ago, the first miner went missing. 2 days later, another 2 miners went missing. Since then, another 4 miners and 2 children have vanished. So yeah, so It's a one-shot horror adventure designed for a party of four level 8 adventurers. You'll find a setting neutral adventure that can be used as a side quest, or you can incorporate into your main campaign. Introductory game to create a party backstory, even if you're playing with brand new characters, and a whole lot more. And you can get all that for only $3.95 over on DM's Guild. I will, of course, post a link to that in the show notes. Go give it a try. Go support a brand new indie creator. It's terrifying for folks like that to take the plunge. So let them know it's not as bad as they feared. You know, let them know that there are people out there that are willing to that want to support this sort of endeavor. But that being said, let's jump back into the show. Welcome back from the middle of the show. I just want to jump right back into these planes.
Yes, please.
I want to jump into Bytopia.
Oh, all these layers and Bytopia. I am starting to get hungry, I think.
From what? For what?
You keep talking about all these layers and I keep thinking about cake. And then you said Bytopia, and now I'm thinking about biting something with layers.
No, not Bytopia,
no?
Bytopia, because it's dual layers. You know, one it's called the Twin Paradises. Now here's a place, two actually, where a cutter can find a good job or comfy case. All sorts of beings choose to live around here. There's plenty of wild animals, even some of them giant kinds. There's magical creatures too, and of course the powers that reside here. All in all, it's a pretty nice place to live. It ain't fancy, but a body could find a worse place to set his case. And that comes from Jesper Highnose, a gnome traveler.
Well, he's just precious.
I knew you would think so. So yeah, like the name Bytopia, made of two layers, Dothian and Shirok. The two layers, each glowing with a golden white light. They're joined at one barrier, which happens to span the entire sky at about 10 miles or 16 kilometers above sea level. So the inhabitants could like look up and see the other layer hanging upside down high overhead.
No, thank you.
No, it's fine because like gravity for each layer is normal for that layer, but then switches direction as soon as you cross the barrier. So it's fine. It's fine.
That's terrifying.
Several mountains reach the crossover point, and a few mountains rising up, a few meet other mountains rising up from the other side, which allow careful climbers a way to reach the other layer. So you climb up a mountain in Dothian, and then you somehow you're able to kind of like get over to another mountaintop in Shirok, and then climb down that one, and now you're there.
You just like handstand on the top of it and like flip your legs down and then walk down the other side.
Yep,
just...
exactly. It's exactly what I meant when I said carefully get to the other mountain. That's exactly what I meant. It's just handstand and then just flip your legs over.
I mean, you gotta be real careful though, because what if you go I'm just picturing someone trying to switch layers. It was just shift over to this other mountain and face plants because the other side's gravity picks up. Weren't quite sure where the boundary was.
Oh, it was a little bit closer than I thought.
A little closer. Yeah.
You could also fly from one side to the other as well.
That,
you know?
Yeah, I guess that'd probably make it easier.
The animals in the Twin Paradises are sentient with above or average intelligence or above, but they do not have the ability to speak. Some trees are also intelligent, you know, making them similar to the tree ants on the prime material plane. Mm-hmm. The usual menagerie of upper plane creatures are found here, including solars, devas, baku, others. Dothian was a bucolic land of old forests, huge meadows that are subject to only a mild temperature change, you know, and mm-hmm. you know, typically mild weather with benign seasons.
Okay.
The landscape is orderly, domesticated. You know, you have a lot of farms prospering and growing. you know, animals confined to the properties of their owners. Mm-hmm. Water powered mills make flour and meal. You know, very like pastoral. Like when you think
pleasant.
Right, like when you think of kind of like walking through like farms and villages in like Skyrim.
Yeah, it's just very commoners' villages.
Right. And the roads are well traveled, but also well kept.
Oh, nice.
The farmers of the lair, the miners, the smiths, the artisans spend their lives joyfully producing food and wooden and metal items like art, jewelry, clothing, from the raw materials that are widely available. And the workshops and towns are dedicated to nothing but the common good.
Ooh.
So you got portals to the seven heavens here, obviously. Elysium, that makes a lot of sense as well. These are found in caverns as brightly glowing patterns. You got concentric mm-hmm. circles for the seven heavens and radiating lines for Elysium. And for the layers that go to the concordant opposition, these are often superimposed and they resemble more of a spider web. So you definitely know, you know, where you're going with these, as opposed to some layers where you have no idea where you might go.
Yeah.
Travelers.
Oh, yeah. That might be helpful, I guess. I suppose.
Right. To know where you're going. Travelers from the astral plane would emerge from the color pools on this layer. And this layer is also home of the locale of Deep Home, which is, and I noted this specifically for this reason. It's a realm of the Snurfneblin god Caladurin.
Snurfneblin.
Caladurin Smooth Hands. That god.
You just wanted to say his name.
Caladurin Smooth Hands.
Caladurin Smooth Hands.
Which we have to do an episode on him too. Have to.
So, of course.
Across the barrier, Shirok has the same sort of like landscape features, but much mm-hmm. harsher weather. You know, the summers are more hot. The winters are longer and colder. And unlike the, you know, mild winter and clear skies of the other layer, Dathian, the weather on Shirok, also known as Stormwracked, is harsh and unpredictable. As keeping with its nickname, storms are more common here. Booming thunder, heavy rains. So in general, life on the Shirok side is more challenging and keeps the inhabitants
Sounds
busy.
Like it.
Yeah, but both sides are virtuously industrious.
Oh,
so,
nice.
Yeah, it doesn't really, you know, kind of like sour their attitudes, which is cool.
Mm-hmm.
The landscape is very mountainous, abundant creeks, rivers that flow fast through the lair. And the lair also has an abundance of raw materials. And just like its, you know, just like its companion lair, Shirok is a place of hard work and satisfaction from a job well done. But instead of taming the land, work on Shirok focuses on the extraction of the natural resources. So the wild landscape of the lair is peppered with mines, mills, quarries. But due to the harsh weather and the rocky, irregular terrain, most dwellings and active work sites are actually underground.
Oh.
And
That makes sense. I get it.
And I love this. So in order to transport these raw materials from Shirok to Dothian, you know, like that weird, like traveling up and then then kind of like flipping over and then traveling down. Traders first have to brave the harsh weather of the lair to either reach a portal to Dothian, which is usually controlled by guilds that charge high tariffs, or transport them directly there using a floating gnomish contraption.
That sounds about right.
So, taking advantage of the unique configuration of Vitopia, traders put their goods into protected baskets and sew together large pieces of tarp into bags, which they then fill with hot air. So, much like a hot air balloon.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
So, you know, so after a attaching enough of these bags, it begins to float up until it reaches the divide between the layers. And so by the time that the load crosses the divide and starts falling toward Dothian, the cooling air has lost enough of its buoyancy for the cargo to gently descend into the lair.
Very nice. It makes me kind of sad and kind of happy at the same time that they've created balloons.
They created balloons.
Aw, you poor little things.
It's also home, Shirok is, to an adamantite dragon named Merciala.
Oh. Drop a dragon in there?
She's going to drop a dragon into this Stardew Valley type situation.
Yeah, it's all precious and adorable. And there's a dragon.
Some claim that the adamantite dragons, you know, all live on Bytopia. But, you know, sightings of these, you know, plural dragons in different parts of the plane, it's really just, you know, her getting around.
Oh.
But never fear, she is the self-appointed guardian of all that is good in this rugged area. And often teams up with air sentinels who also make their home here to keep the lair as safe as she can.
I'd boop it.
I mean, and you might survive this one because your heart is true.
Mm-hmm.
You come from a pure place of absolute ignorance.
It's just purely wanting to boop all the things. It's from a place of love.
Well, you're not going to want to boop anything in our last layer. The gray waste.
I'm okay. Thanks.
The waste takes your dreams and perverts them. It grants your deepest wishes and then takes them away. For the first few days that you're here, you have incredibly vivid dreams, and your imagination runs rampant. It goes faster and faster until you realize you're running out of ideas, until you realize that this place has sucked everything from you. There's precious little that'll keep you from ending it all then, unless you can hold on to a scrap from your past and nurture it till it becomes a hope for the future, or you just fade away into nothingness. That's from Dalton the Gray, described as a terminal visitor to the waste.
Aww.
So, yeah, I would say if you're a terminal visitor to the gray waste, I'd say being called
your
the gray.
Your life choices.
Yeah. Also, yeah, choices. Come on.
Your life choices, sir.
So the demons are the presumed ruler of Hades, which is what the gray waste is also known as. But they're actually outnumbered by this really interesting bird-like avian type creature called the Dayak, who are the natives to the plain. Additionally, you know, factions of Demodans carry on this like low-level insurgency sort of rebellion, like sniping at the demons, but generally avoid large-scale conflict that might attract the attention of the resident deities.
Well, that's smart.
Yeah, exactly. Also known to inhabit all the layers of Hades were nightmares, like not just, you know, the kind you have in your sleep, but also like the horses, night hags and others. Most souls that arrive in Hades become larvae, like these sickly human-headed worm spirits that are harvested by the night hags as a commodity for lower plane commerce.
Oh, fantastic.
So the worms are their dollars. There are three layers in Hades in the Gray Waste. They're actually called glooms, and for good reason, because the realms are utterly devoid of emotion, of hope, of peace.
Oh.
Obviously,
it's the doldrums.
Yeah. It's a gray land, a gray sky throughout, no sun, no moon, or seasons to brighten up anything. And what's interesting here is that any color other than shades of gray would obviously be obvious, you know, against the background.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
But then they would also fade to gray in about a week or two.
Oh.
And like bright colors, beings also begin to fade. You know, at first they feel the drain of emotions, leaving only sadness and, you know, apathy, defeatism. And after a 10-day or two, they would be trapped in Hades in the Gray Waste, and their existence would begin to fade until they actually become that larva that is then, harvested by a night hag and then used to buy like a soup or something. I don't know. I don't know what night hags you need money
they
for.
Buy soup? Yeah. I mean, I guess they do go out and buy their soup. They're using their cauldrons for other things.
Exactly. Hades is a unique plane because it's not only joined to the adjacent planes in the Great Wheel. It also holds the foundation of both Mount Olympus and the roots of Yggdrasil, the world ash.
Oh.
So these two planar artifacts connected Hades to Olympus and Ysgard and allow travel between Hades and the upper planes and alternate prime material planes without having to go through the astral plane. But, I mean, it's a shortcut for sure, but God, it's a hell of a shortcut.
I don't.
So let's talk about the layers. So Oinos, the first layer of Hades, was named for the lord of the demons, the Oino demon, Anthracus the Decayed.
Oh.
Yeah. It's awesome. So, like,
a fantastic name.
I need that on, like, I need that. I need a band named Anthracus the Decayed.
Oh, I'm here for it.
So Oinos was the land of disease with stunted and withered plants amid this rocky gray terrain. Our old friend, the River Styx, flows through the lair, of course. And there are portals to Tartarus, Gehenna, that look, and this made me laugh because it made me think of like old school Mario. Looks like huge spinning metal coins visible for miles, often guarded by iron fortresses.
Yeah, or Donkey Kong.
Yeah.
Any of the DK games.
Yep.
The DK coins. That's what those are.
Exactly. Anyone walking this land or floating on the River Styx has a chance of contracting a major disease called the Wasting Sickness, which was believed had to do with the many rotting corpses which the aforementioned Blood War produced. So, all these dead devils and dead demons, they just leave them there, I guess. get sick.
Yeah, what are you going to do with them? Bury them?
Well, I guess they're not going to do anything with them because many of the demons and a lot of the other creatures from the lower middle planes who make their homes here are actually immune to the disease. So if it's not affecting them, I guess they don't care.
I guess it's not a problem. Ew.
The landscape consists mostly of plains with the occasional hill, and it's the primary battleground of the Blood War. Like I mentioned earlier, all those dead bodies. So it was where the fighting was the fiercest, the most constant, and it's how it got its nickname, the Battle Plain. There are stunted trees because the other plant life is routinely destroyed because the fiendish armies are just trampling all over it.
Right.
In addition to that, the sounds of battle could be heard anywhere on the lair.
Oh, I believe it.
Compared to Oinos, the second lair, or the second lair in this plane, Niflheim.
Niflheim or Niflheim?
Niflheim. It's Niflheim.
That's Niflheim. That makes me real happy. That is a silly name.
Well, it's not a silly place. The landscape is rougher. Foothills, cooler temperatures, healthier vegetation, including like pine trees, and no disease.
Oh.
But everything is soaked in this dreary fog and mist, which limits vision to about 100 feet or roughly 30 meters. Second, so that impedes your vision. Second, it has sound impeding effects.
Don't
so
like that.
Those two, the combination of those two, make this a hunting ground for predators like trolls, both fiendish and dire and normal wolves being the most common and dangerous.
So many types of wolves. I mean, and it's literally see no evil, hear no evil until evil consumes you.
And then
nom, nom, nom.
Third, the resulting dampness causes non-tended metal to rust.
Oh.
Niflheim is also known as Northmen's Despair. Consists mostly of forest land with bluffs to kind of just jut out and then quickly fall away. And to be honest, it looks a lot just like a grayscale version of just regular forest land from the prime material plane.
Oh, okay.
So like, you know, like a lush forest, but like sad. Like just a bummer.
Like, I mean, I vibe with being lush and sad. I get it.
As I mentioned, Yggdrasil, the world ash, has its roots in the heart of Niflheim. There, the dragon Nidhogg endlessly and furiously chews on the tree, carving a hole in its root. The dragon will usually ignore travelers going up and down the branches, but will furiously defend herself and her progeny against any threat. And this was most interesting to me. I wanted to, yeah, this might be like a mini episode if I can find more information on it, but there's a town mm-hmm. called Death of Innocence that is unique as its citizens don't succumb to the normal like hopelessness and apathy of Hades, of the Grey Waste.
Interesting. Okay.
So yeah, I'd be really interested to see like how that comes about. Mm-hmm. And then our old friend Char, the goddess, once used to have a home here.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Exactly. And then finally, the lowest level of Hades. I was going to say the lowest level of hell. The lowest level of Hades is known as the Olympian's Gloom. So Pluton contains the base of Mount Olympus, and it is a direct conduit through the astral plane to the plane of Arborea.
Okay.
The gray motif, obviously it's a gray waste, continues. But Pluton is not as cold as Niflheim, and it's still like a relatively temperate, cool place. Its vegetation is that of a subtropical place.
It's a
doozy of a word. With willows, olive trees. But these trees are in the state of dying. And it says, and for an unknown but very long time. So these trees have been
taking forever to die.
And it's believed that these trees had petitioners of the lair inside them, and that druids could feel the tree's sadness.
Haunted forest.
Exactly. The blood war is not waged on this lair, but sometimes fiends come to get the soul of a particularly skilled person. Like I said, it has the base of Mount Olympus, which is located near the entrance to the realm of Hades. Since it avoided the upper layers of Oinos and Niflheim, it was used frequently by travelers despite being a little bit more dangerous and treacherous. There's a city named Corpus on this layer that was made of people.
I was about to say, I wonder what it's made of, because I know how D&D names things.
It's made of people. The streets
it's made of people.
Are made of living bodies.
Wait, I'm sorry. What? Living?
Living bodies. You are walking on living people. And if we weren't surprised that Char used to kick it in Niflheim, it should be no surprise that legend goes that the Raven Queen was originally a sorceress who led a rebellion against a god of death who held domain in Pluton.
Where Char goes.
I mean, yeah,
it's not a far jump. I'm just saying.
You know, so other deities recognized her as one of their own, but in order to prevent her from becoming a tyrant, much like the defeated deity, they granted her domain over death, but not over the dead themselves.
Just that tiny little moment of death.
Yeah, that's all you
just
get.
Just that one moment. But what an intimate moment.
Well, that wraps it up this week for the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. Again, we will be discussing Beastlands and Carceri in the Patron Plus installment of this episode. So if you're interested in hearing that, head on over to patreon.com/dndlorecast. And until then next week, we've got our patron roundtable. It's going to be a humdinger. Ooh. We're doing some homebrew
stuff.
Yeah, we do. It's going to be fun. And then after that, we got even more Planescape. We're just barreling toward Planescape.
It's plain to see.
Thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for putting up with me.
My name is Sergio.
And I'm Mary.
Fare thee well, dear listener. And until we meet again, may all your 20s be natural.
Thank you for listening to the Dungeons & Dragons Lorecast. If you've enjoyed the show, consider following us on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok at @DNDLorecast. Or jumping into the Robots Radio Discord to chat more with us about Dungeons & Dragons. We'll see you soon.
You've been listening to a Robots Radio podcast. Smart shows for interesting people. Check out all the shows at robotsradio.net.